Late in the afternoon of Sunday, May 22, 2011, an F5 tornado hit Joplin, Missouri, killing 158 people, injuring 1,150 others, and causing $2.8 billion in damage. These people were just going about their daily lives, and then they were struck by a natural disaster completely outside their control. They were helpless to stop it, but that wouldn't exempt them from the devastating aftermath. I remember sitting and just crying as I watched the news and Facebook, because for me, this wasn't just another news story. For me, this was home. A lot of my family still lives in Joplin. Their lives would be forever changed by this day. Their church was destroyed. Lifelong friends' homes were completely gone. But there was more than simply material loss. My parents lost close friends. Their world was turned upside down. My mom said that although she had lived in the area for 35 years, when she went to that part of town where the tornado had devastated, she didn't even know where she was because there were no landmarks left. It's an eerie feeling to be lost in your own hometown. But for many, there was also a realization that all of the strongholds, those things that they had depended on to be indestructible, were just gone in an instant. Here's a picture of St. John's Regional Medical Center before and after the tornado. You see, this was one of those places. This is where people went to get healing when they were hurting or sick. But now people were hurting and the hospital was gone. But for those who had eyes to see and ears to hear, they also learned that sometimes things which are very fragile and perhaps unimportant in man's eyes are miraculously brought through such storms. As with any such incident, people begin to question why some were spared, why so many others died. Now, after enough time had passed and that throbbing rawness of the memories began to ebb, people began to see that perhaps they had not gone through that storm alone. There were so many stories of circumstances that were just simply out of the norm, but that moved people out of harm's way. They may have only appeared as little things that skeptics could easily dismiss as coincidence, but the sheer number of the stories stacked up to a level that even the local media could not ignore. A couple that are like second parents to my husband and I were visiting their new great-grandbaby at the other hospital in town. They would have been traveling home just as the tornado hit, but they had to leave earlier than intended because his oxygen tank malfunctioned. It has never done that before. The stories were so numerous that the local media actually even wrote articles discussing the possibility of divine intervention. I thought about all of this when I went back through Ruth. I imagine that Naomi felt many of these same emotions and maybe thought the same thoughts. She had no control over the famine, but that didn't change the fact that her two babies were in danger of dying. She had no control of her husband's decision to go against the Mosaic law and seek refuge in a forbidden land, but that didn't protect her from the dangers of a very long and hard journey. She had no control of her husband and son's deaths, but that didn't change the fact that she was now a vulnerable widow left alone in a foreign land with no hope of protection or survival. But we will find as we go through this amazing book that she was not alone. Her pain had blinded her eyes to the guiding presence of her God, but he was there nonetheless. Storms come into our lives in many ways. Job losses, health concerns, divorce, loss of a loved one. Perhaps you sense a storm coming on the horizon. Perhaps you find yourself in the eye of the storm. Or maybe you're at that place where you're picking up the pieces and trying to rebuild. Wherever this study finds you, I hope that you will be encouraged as we dig into this amazing little book. So this week, we looked at the big picture of the book of Ruth. We learned that Ruth was Hebrew narrative, which does not mean that it's fictional. This is history told in story form. My youngest daughter, Nora, loves it when I tell her family stories. Her favorite one is when my grandmother met Bonnie and Clyde at a barn dance and sewed up Bonnie Parker's dress when it got ripped on a nail. Well, you see, Ruth would have been one of these local stories. when things got rough and maybe people were beginning to doubt God's faithfulness or his provision, the elders of the town, the grandmas and the grandpas and the mothers and the fathers would gather everyone around and they'd say, "But don't forget, remember Boaz and Ruth and God's great faithfulness to Naomi." As the years passed, it might well have been one of David's favorite family stories. I wonder how often it would have come to mind as he was running from Saul in the wilderness. How many times did he close his eyes as he laid down in a cave with his stomach growling and remember back to God's faithfulness during the famine? And now when he became king, the story became of national importance because it showed how God had worked during one of the darkest times in the nation's history to plant a seed that would bring in the greatest king in the history of Israel. Well, nearly the greatest king. Because many generations later, another child from this line would be born who would make this story of worldwide importance. Because where Boaz is Naomi and Ruth's kinsman redeemer, and David is the great king of the nation of Israel, Jesus, the son of David, is the kinsman redeemer of all mankind and will reign as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So open your Bibles to Ruth 1, and we'll spend some time reviewing the background of the book, and then we'll dig in and work our way through the passage. Now, the book of Ruth gives us a lot of information as to the characters, setting, and plot. If this were a play, I could imagine the narrator coming out onto stage and saying, "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, the name of the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the women were bereft of her two children and her husband." There's a lot of information packed into these five verses. First, we get the setting, both time and place. Now, although the story proper begins in Moab, the narrator tells us that the story actually began some 10 years before in the land of Judah in a town called Bethlehem. Although famous today, at the time of Ruth, Bethlehem was really only a small farming community. It became important because of the things that happened there. It was the birthplace of both David and Jesus. And all of that starts with the events that we're studying right here in the book of Ruth. We also spent some time this week looking at Moab. We saw that the Moabites were the descendants of Lot through his oldest daughter. Remember when Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, the girls were afraid that there would be no one left to marry and carry on their family line. So they got their father drunk and conceived through him. The oldest daughter gave birth to the father of the Moabites, and the youngest gave birth to the father of the Ammonites. So the Moabites were kind of like extended family to the Israelites. But when Moses brought the nation of Israel up from Egypt, the Moabites didn't treat them like family. They refused to help them with food and water, and then they hired a prophet named Balaam to curse them. Of course, God did not allow this and turned each of Balaam's curses into blessings. And this is where we get the great story of Balaam's donkey. When Balaam couldn't curse Israel, he told the Moabites to seduce the Israelites with idolatry. He couldn't curse them, but he knew how to get them to bring a curse upon themselves. And so in Deuteronomy 23:5-6, because of Moab's part in this, God forbids the nation of Israel to seek the peace and prosperity of Moab. Now, these verses also tell us that this happened in the days when the judges judged. If you've ever spent much time in the book of Judges, you know that it is not a golden age of spirituality. Judges 17:6 and 21:25 tell us that during this time, every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now, this should be contrasted with doing what is right based on the revelation of God. In the Garden of Eden, God told Adam and Eve not to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but they did what was right in their own eyes and ate it anyway. So this should not be mistaken for discerning behavior, such as picking the school district that best fits your child, or choosing a stock portfolio to fit your needs, or even finding that adult fellowship that fits your personality. This was sin. And when you read the book of Judges, you see atrocities performed that would even shock today's HBO viewers. The nation of Israel had been given covenantal promises and the Mosaic Law. A detailed description of what good looked like had been revealed to them. But they chose to embrace that which was good in their own eyes, and they forsook that which was good in God's eyes. This might be a good time for a heart check. One of the basic principles of Bible study is to find a way to bridge the gap between the culture, time, and language when a book was written and that of current day. Because so many of the customs and traditions are just different then than now. However, of any time of the Bible, the time of the Judges may be the easiest for us to relate to because we increasingly live in a time when our society does what is right in their own eyes. So I can't help but check my own heart and prayerfully ask God to show me places where I'm neglecting His word for my own pleasures, preferences, and perspectives. What about you? Where are you allowing your own opinions to overrule what God has revealed? We also get introduced to most of our characters in these first five verses. This week, we looked at their names and what they mean in Hebrew. We learned that Elimelech was "my God is king," but that he did what was right in his own eyes and went against the commands of the law. We learned that the famine was so severe that Mahlon was weakly and Chilion was pining. We learn that Orpah probably had a beautiful long neck like the models who walk the runway. Naomi was pleasant until she gave up hope, and then she was Mara, which means bitter. Ruth means friendship, and Boaz was swift of strength. We even see that there was no food in Bethlehem, which is the house of bread. Even the names carry the story along. So we've covered roughly 10 years in the first five verses. But now the narrator moves back into the shadows, the spotlight comes on, and Naomi is center stage. And Naomi gets a key piece of information. So we pick up the story in verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. So she departed from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to the journey, to return to the land of Moab, or to Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "But no, but we will surely return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it's harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." And when she, Naomi, saw that she, Ruth, was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. Although at first blush, the big news would appear to be merely that the famine was over. There was food again in the house of bread. But look again at what the text said. The Lord had visited his people in giving them food. Now, everyone understood that this wasn't just a, whew, we finally got some rain. They understood that something supernatural had happened. The Lord had visited his people. The word translated here as visited means to look at or to see to something. When the subject is God, it's always used in a caring, tender, and personal way. The Hebrew root is the same that is used for someone who takes care of a fatherless child. It's used in Genesis 21:1 when God allowed Sarah, who was 79 years old, to conceive and bear Isaac, the promised child. It's used again in 1 Samuel 2:21 when God allows Hannah to conceive and bear Samuel. And in Genesis 50:24, Joseph on his deathbed promises his brethren that God would visit them and bring them up from the land of Egypt. And it's used three times in Exodus as God fulfills that promise. See, this is an expression of special concern. God has visited his people and showed concern and mercy for them. Now, this may be one of those places where you may be tempted to pass over the text to get to the good stuff, but there's so much in this verse. You see, the issue wasn't just that there was now food in Bethlehem, because there was also food in Moab. Naomi was already in a place with plenty of food. That wasn't her concern. She needed to get to a place where she could be protected and cared for. At this time, there weren't food banks, charities, or Medicare for widows or orphans. If a woman didn't have a family, specifically male heirs, to take care of her, she was desolate. If a young woman did not remarry and did not have family, she would often be forced into prostitution to provide for herself. I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan, and there's a scene where Frodo has been injured by the Ringwraiths. The group is trying to get him to safety in the elven city of Rivendell, where he can be healed, but they're being hunted by the Ringwraiths. And they know if they can just get him past the river, that the elven magic will protect him. And it does. The river actually rises up itself and destroys the Ringwraiths. Well, in our story, Naomi knows that if she can just get back to her land, to the land of Israel and to her people, that she will be protected. Not by elven magic, but by covenant promises. God had made covenant promises of protection for his people. He had decreed that special care was to be taken of widows and orphans. When Elimelech left the land, he also left the protection of the divine covenants. There is protection in obedience. There was no such protection in Moab. Now, the story doesn't tell us why Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion died, so we don't know if there was some sort of divine judgment against them. But we can tell from Naomi's discussion in chapter 1, verse 13, that she thinks that maybe there was. Here she makes it very clear that she believes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against her. Now, this may have just been the rawness of her loss and pain speaking. But in her mind, God wasn't just ignoring her or unaware of her needs. He was actively acting against her. So Naomi doesn't expect any special consideration for herself. But she knows if she can just make it back to the land and to the covering of the covenant promises, then she will be able to live off the overflow of the blessings that God has poured out on the rest of his people. Remember what I said before, that pain and suffering often blind us to the presence and plan of God's hand in our life? Well, here Naomi is hoping only for the charity of others and expects God to do nothing for her. She would be content with the crumbs off the table of those whom God has blessed. As we dig deeper into this story, we will see that her perception is not correct at all. God has already given her a great gift in the person of Ruth, and he has even greater things in store for her. She knew and believed that the Lord would and had visited his people with blessing, but she wasn't sure if he would be willing to visit and show concern for her. Naomi still had some hard days ahead of her, but God had really big plans. She wasn't destined for crumbs, because she too was a daughter of the covenant. Wow, I have to tell you, that hit me between the eyes the first time I saw it, because I am guilty of this very thing. In times of grief and suffering, I've misunderstood God this way. What about you? Where are you allowing the pain and suffering of this fallen world to distort the way you see God's hand in your life? I've been content to see myself as merely a wallflower in God's bigger plan. But ladies, we are not wallflowers to God. If you're a believer in Jesus Christ, then you're part of the bride. We are the apple of Christ's eye. We are his beloved, and he died for us. I don't know about you, but I think that's worth writing down and putting it somewhere that I will see every day. I am not a wallflower to Jesus. I am his beloved. For a lot of years, and I continue to wrestle with this interchange in verse 8 through 15 between Naomi and her daughters-in-law. It bothers me that she was going back to the worship of the one and only living God and leaving them to the worship of false gods. Not only that, but these gods were really bad guys. If you had time to work on the digging deeper question this week, you saw that there was great atrocities involved in the worship of Molech. Children were burned alive. Human sacrifices were offered. And the priests would go through the villages and choose the pretty young girls to be temple prostitutes for their own pleasure. What was Naomi thinking? Well, I think there are a couple of things that we need to consider. Remember that Naomi did not expect the living God, the God of Israel, to take care of her. She felt that he was working against her. She was so broken and blinded by pain that she was just hoping that others would take pity on her. She didn't expect that anyone guilty by association, especially her Moabite daughter-in-laws, would be taken care of either. Second, in her eyes, in her mind, in that time, for a woman, security meant one thing: marriage with male heirs. Remember, that was her trouble. She was now a childless widow with no one to take care of. She was just thinking about their physical well-being. And it's obvious from this exchange that she loved Orpah and Ruth very much, and they loved her. She just wanted them to be taken care of. Although the Mosaic law provided for the young childless widows through the Levirate law of marriage, Naomi knew that there was no refuge for Orpah and Ruth there, because she was too old to provide a Levirate or brother-in-law to marry them. You know the old saying that when you point one finger at someone else, you point three back at yourself? I realize that I've been far harder on Naomi than I have been on myself. Naomi did not have a fully developed doctrine of personal eschatology, or in English, she didn't know about Jesus on the cross. She didn't have Romans to explain the eternal consequences of sin. In the Old Testament, salvation was very much about physical deliverance, pointing to that greater deliverance that would be offered through the blood of Jesus on the cross. She didn't have that. But I do. And I found in my prayers for my loved ones or my conversations with my loved ones that I was often more concerned about the physical comfort and security than I was about their relationship with the living God. Not only that, too often I was more concerned with my own physical comfort and security than I was with my walk with the Lord. What about you? Where are you allowing comfort and convenience to become more important than a pure and honest walk before God? Well, while I'm confessing, I have to confess that I've also been too hard on Orpah. I've always held her up against Ruth, but that's unfair. Orpah did exactly what was expected of her, and no more, but also no less. She didn't fail Naomi. She just didn't go above and beyond. See, the issue here wasn't good versus bad, where Ruth is good and Orpah is bad. This is an issue of good versus exemplary. You see, one of the themes of this book is what the Hebrew called hesed. It's a loyal, unfailing, covenantal love which always seeks the best for the recipient. Where Orpah loved Naomi, Ruth shows hesed. For me, her vow in verses 15 through 17 is one of the most poignant and moving passages of Scripture. She is making a covenant vow to stand by Naomi until the very end, if need be. If you want to understand what covenant love between humans look like, take a really long look at Ruth. She loves sacrificially. She's no ostrich with her head stuck in the sand. She doesn't expect anything in Bethlehem except gleaning and scraping by. But that doesn't matter. She's a woman of hesed. She will leave behind everything that she has, her home, her family, her traditions, her culture, her identity, to stand by Naomi. Can you imagine that kind of love? Have you ever been loved by someone that completely? If you're a believer in the Lord Jesus, then yes, you have. Have you ever loved someone that sacrificially? If you have brothers and sisters in Christ, then you should. While I may have been too hard on Orpah, I need to not be too easy on myself. What kind of woman do I want to be? Do I want to just do the bare minimum in my relationship with God and with my fellow believers? Or do I want to be a woman of chesed? What about you? What do you want your spiritual legacy to be? While I'm here, can I share something that's just really close to my heart? You see, there's a really strong parallel in the relationship between Ruth and Naomi, the Gentile daughter-in-law and the Jewish mother, and in the relationship that should exist between the church and Israel, the primarily Gentile daughter-in-law and the Jewish mother of Christ. We may very well be entering days when the entire world will turn against Israel. Please, please don't be an Orpah and turn back to follow the Lord, the world. Please be a Ruth and support the people of God. Finally, we come to the end of Act 1 of Ruth. In verse 19, "So they both went until they came to Bethlehem, and it came about when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, 'Is this Naomi?' And she said to them, 'Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?' So Naomi returned, and with Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest." Naomi and Ruth make it back to Bethlehem. Naomi tells the women of the village to call her Mara because she is bitter about her emptiness. As the curtain closes on the first chapter, our star Naomi has no hope. She is bitter and feels very alone. Much like my mom after the tornado, she feels lost in her own hometown. But this is only the end of chapter 1. The author gives us a very hidden message of hope. You see, verse 22 tells us that they arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. See, on the festival calendar, that would have been the Feast of First Fruits, when the whole nation celebrated a new supply in the land. As I said before, God has wonderful plans of mercy and deliverance for Naomi. By the end of the book, not only will her belly be full in the house of bread, her soul will be also. He has a wonderful new supply planned for her in the land. At the beginning of this, I shared how the people of my hometown learned that sometimes things that seem of great strength and importance are destroyed, and things that appear very fragile are brought through safely. My mother gave me a very special gift. This crystal bowl was from a house that was destroyed in the Joplin tornado. The big hospital didn't make it. Even the house that this bowl was in didn't make it. But this fragile piece of crystal did. When she first gave it to me, it was covered with dirt and grime, and that could be expected. After all, it had been through a lot. It's got a couple of chips, one thin surface crack, but when I cleaned it up, it still shines. I keep it in my office with a candle in it, and every time I look at it, I think of Naomi. You see, in the time of Ruth, there was nothing more vulnerable than a widow. At the end of this chapter, she's pretty dingy and bitter. But God's going to do some miraculous things in hers and Ruth's lives. And by the end of the book, she is going to be sparkling with the reflected light of His glory. My prayer is that we learn from her and that we do the same. You may be in some stage of the storm and feel pretty beaten and weather battered, but hang in there. Don't let the grime of the storm or the chips and scratches of suffering keep you from catching and reflecting His glory.